We've come to the final unit for the term. Just like the last couple, it has three chapters in it. The first of which we're starting today is called Meiosis and Sexual Life Cycles. We'll get into meiosis in a moment, but let's talk about sex first. Sexual reproduction is just one kind of reproduction, and it's more recent. The original form of reproduction was asexual reproduction, which still exists, of course, and is still by far more prevalent than sexual reproduction, simply because bacteria just by themselves are by far most organisms that exist right now, and they reproduce asexually. They're not the only ones that do, though. Anyway, asexual reproduction is been around for much longer. Sexual reproduction has been around for a while, though, and has been really successful. But let's first distinguish them before we talk more about pros and cons of either one. Asexual reproduction involves only one parent. So a single parent produces some number of offspring asexually, which results in offspring, however many there are, that are genetically identical to that single parent. So asexual reproduction basically makes organisms that are copies of the original. They're genetically identical to each other and to the parent. Sexual reproduction, on the other hand, involves two parents, each of which contribute some genetic material, so that the offspring of sexual reproducers, however many there are not genetically identical to either parent, and they're also genetically different from each other. So other than the fact that it involves two parents, the huge difference with sexual reproduction is that it mixes things up genetically. Now, there's nothing saying that one is better than the other. It just depends. Both sexual reproduction and asexual reproduction have drawbacks and advantages. Under what situation would asexual reproduction be, if you had a choice, and some organisms do, by the way, but we don't. But if you did have a choice, in what situation would you think that asexual reproduction would be advantageous, based on what it is? I still didn't hear you. No, well, plants can do both. Most plants can. But why would you say plants? The let me just say no. That's the things that are advantageous about sexual reproduction are true of plants, just as they're true for any other sexually reproducing species. But back to the original question, under what situations would asexual reproduction be the way to go? Considering that it produces offspring that are genetically identical to the parent. When would you want that to happen?
If a species is endangered, a certain species is endangered?
Well, think of it in terms of individuals, because individuals are what reproduce. If an individual is very well adapted to its surroundings, in other words, the particular DNA that it has, the version of genes that it possesses which indirectly determine its traits, those traits work really well for the situation in which that organism lives. That's the definition of being well adapted, right? I should say right. That's more of a 182 thing that you might not have learned yet. But if your particular traits are well suited to the conditions in which you live, which is just another way of saying that you're well adapted, then why would you want to change anything? Under those situations, making an identical copy of yourself as your offspring would mean that your offspring should be just as well adapted as you, because your offspring will have those same traits. And that is the huge advantage of asexual reproduction. But what's the potential problem with that?
Environment evolves to destroy your kind.
Well, I'm just going to take your first two important words. Environments change. That's the problem. Yes, it would mean that if you were very well adapted, your offspring would be too, assuming the environment doesn't change. But in real environments do change, and they can change drastically in relatively short amount of time. You know, if there's a catastrophic event or something. So that's the drawback of asexual reproduction. If the environment does change, then your particular version of DNA, your particular set of traits, is no longer going to be all that great if the environment changes. And if that's all you can make as offspring, then those offspring won't do as well as you did. All right? Now, sexual reproduction, on the other hand, is pretty much a crapshoot, because the DNA that gets donated by each of the two parents involved is random. I mean, it comes from each parent, but the particular combination of genes that the offspring have, half from one parent and half from another parent, is a totally random assortment of genes. And therefore, you really have no idea what you're going to get as far as offspring are concerned. And it's very possible that offspring produced by sexual reproduction will not be as well adapted as either of the parents were before them, which would be disadvantageous, right? Except that every single offspring is different from its siblings. So even though sex can result in offspring that aren't as well adapted as the parents, it can also randomly result in offspring that are better adapted, even if the environment changes. You know, if the environment changes, especially for species that have a hell of a lot of offspring, there's a chance that at least one of those offspring will be better adapted to that new environment than either parent would be. All right, so that's the main advantage of sexual reproduction. But they both have advantages, they both have disadvantages. A disadvantage of sexual reproduction is simply that it's more complicated. You have to involve two organisms. So it's just, you know, more, it can be an expense of energy, because in some cases there's mating. There isn't always mating. For instance, trees don't mate, but they're sexually reproducing. They have to get their gametes together, but they don't actually come into contact, the individuals. But animals often mate, and that can be an expensive thing to do, to go through all the stuff involved with getting a mate, which, you know, anything you spend energy on takes energy away from surviving, doing things that will just survive, allow you to survive. So there's pros and cons to both. The opening slide just shows you a couple pictures of representative organisms from each of the two major schemes. This hydra on the left is a protist. Remember what a protist is? A protist is any eukaryote that is not an animal, plant, or a fungus. And so this one happens to be a hydra, but asexual reproduction is not only done by many eukaryotes, it's also the way that prokaryotes in general reproduce. So archaeans and bacteria also reproduce asexually. There are different ways in which asexual reproduction can work. This hydra that you see undergoes what's called budding, where basically a carbon copy version, genetically speaking, just sprouts out of the side of the body of the original parent and then eventually detaches. Redwood, or any major plant that you can think of, is capable of sexual reproduction. So, as I was saying before, that involves two parents. In the case of plants, they are planted, which means they don't get up and move around. They don't find each other. But their gametes, which are their sex cells, have to find each other for sexual reproduction to happen. And that actually often involves randomness, too. Randomness of the wind, randomness of some sort of animal brushing up against the pollen and carrying it to another individual. But that makes genetically distinct offspring, and that can be quite an advantage. All right, let's go to two. The black background that you see here in this slide is a photograph of chromosomes taken from a cell and arranged in a specific way. This photographic arrangement is called a karyotype. And what do you notice about that word? Right, it has that same karyo root as prokaryotic, eukaryotic, which means kernel or core. Specifically for a cell that has one, it's referring to the nucleus. And so a karyotype is a photographic depiction of all the chromosomes in a eukaryotic cell arranged by type of chromosome. Now, first of all, I'll talk more about types of chromosomes in a second, but first of all, these chromosomes obviously don't pose for this. This is not a shot that hasn't been edited. Remember when we talked about chromosomes, they are made out of what? Chromatin, which for most of the cell cycle is not very tightly compacted, right? It has to be loose in order to be available for transcription of the genes that are on those chromosomes. So you don't see chromosomes as distinct pieces except when a cell is in cell division. And when is that degree of compactness maximized?
Metaphase?
At metaphase, exactly. So that's specifically when these photographs are taken for karyotypes, because that gives you the very best chance of seeing all the individual chromosomes distinctly separated from each other. But they don't line up by size, as you see in this photograph. So karyotypes are cut and paste jobs. Now, cut and paste, you're used to of thinking as electronic terms. But the original karyotypes were literal cut and paste. You would take a photograph of the cell, and those chromosomes would be there. You would then print a copy of that, so you'd you have the actual photographic print, and you take real scissors to it, you actually cut it, each one out, and then you actually paste them on a piece of paper, arranging them with, pairing them up because of their identical sizes in each pair, and then arranging the pairs in order of size, as you see here. That's what a karyotype is. And then you take another photograph of that once it's cut and pasted. Well, now you just cut and paste electronically, but you're still doing the same thing. Anyway, the first pair of chromosomes, and what looks like an X here, is not one chromosome. That's a pair of chromosomes. It's easier to look at the cartoon version to the left. This is not only a pair of chromosomes, but the two chromosomes in this pair are each individually replicated chromosomes. Right? So each one of these is already a two-piece thing connected together. We've talked about this before. A replicated chromosome consists of two sister chromatids that are genetically identical, and they're connected to each other at a place called the centromere. That's old stuff at this point. Well, there are two replicated chromosomes here, not just one. Two sets of sister chromatids. These two chromatids are sister chromatids. These two are sister chromatids. But this chromatid and this chromatid are not sister chromatids. They're not identical to each other. But these two replicated chromosomes are arranged together in the karyotype because they correspond to each other. They are the same kind of chromosome as opposed to the number two ones. Each of the two number twos are the same kind, but a number two is not the same kind as a number one. But you can see that an obvious difference between these types of chromosomes is their size. And that's why they arrange them by size. It's the easiest way to tell them apart just by looking at them. But what do I mean by a type of chromosome? Well, a type of chromosome, or two of the same type of chromosome, like these two number ones in this pair, are the same type because they have the same number of genes, and those genes are the same gene families. Meaning that set of genes that's on this chromosome, those correspond to a certain set of characteristics. Okay? Well, that's for a chemical reason, but it shows you that they actually do match. So it just makes it easier than basing it simply on size. But each of these two chromosomes that correspond to each other has the same number of chromosomes that govern the same set of characteristics in the organism, in the cell. But that doesn't mean that the genes are identical to each other. Because as we'll talk more about in other chapters, a gene corresponds to a characteristic, but there can be multiple different versions of the same gene. All right? And that's why, even though these contain the same genes, it's not necessarily the same identical copies of the genes. The genes that are on all the other ones, those control a totally different set of characteristics compared to the genes on this one. And that is why they correspond to each other, because these two number ones have the same set of genes. Well, the word we use for this correspondence is homology. So we say that these two chromosomes pictured here as both number ones are homologous to each other. And therefore, this is not just a pair of chromosomes, it's a homologous pair, or a pair of homologous chromosomes. All right? The two number twos are homologous to each other, and so on. Any given eukaryotic organism has a certain number of chromosome types. We've talked about this before, just kind of offhandedly. that whatever that number is depends on the species. This happens to be a human karyotype, but you could make a karyotype for any eukaryotic species. But this is a human, and humans have 23 kinds of chromosomes. And that's why they're numbered, starting with one as the biggest and going, getting smaller from there. There isn't a pair called number 23, but there is 22, and then the 23rd one, instead of being called the 23, is some combination of X and Y. All right, now, I'll have more to say about that in a second, but first of all, why are there two of each kind here? Right, because humans, like animals in general, are sexually reproducing organisms. They therefore have two parents, each of which donate some chromosomes to the offspring. So there, one of these number ones came from the mother, one came from the father in the original cell that was created during fertilization. And that's true for all the other numbers as well. One came from one parent, one came from the other. That's also why, even though each of the two homologs, as they're called in a pair, have the same genes, they're not necessarily the same versions of genes, because the mother and the father were not genetically identical. So each gave its version of a chromosome to the zygote. All right, now back to this not calling the 23rd pair 23. There is a distinction here between two types of two categories of chromosomes, which is distinct from types of chromosomes, as I was mentioning before. 1 through 22, all of those 22 pairs that are numbered, 1 through 22, are examples of what are called autosomes. And the 23rd pair in humans are examples of sex chromosomes. Chromosome, by the way, as a word, chromo means color, and soma means body. So a chromosome literally means a colorful body. Anyway, I say that because notice that the word autosome ends in somes as well. Well, an autosome is a chromosome. A chromosome is either an autosome or a sex chromosome. What does auto mean? It means self. And even though all of these chromosomes, even the sex chromosomes, are important for that individual's self, the reason that autosomes got their name is because they really are more about that individual being that individual rather than determining anything about the next generation. Sex chromosomes, on the other hand, are chromosomes that are at least partly involved in determining the sex of offspring, if there are any offspring, which is not really so much about that person's life or that individual's life as, and that's why they're not autosomes, even though they do affect that individual's life as well. Okay, so that's the distinction there between autosomes and sex chromosomes. Now, sex chromosomes, by the way, don't do only that. Sex chromosomes, for species that use them, which we do, help determine the sex of the offspring, but they also do a bunch of other important stuff as well. They're just called sex chromosomes since they are involved in that. All right, now we get to three, and a lot of students struggle with these definitions I'm about to give you, so listen carefully and make sure that you tell me if you don't understand it. You should be doing this all along. I shouldn't have to tell you that, but I find that people are afraid to say that they don't understand it. Anyway, we're going to talk about different ways of describing how many chromosomes are in a cell, and this is where the confusion comes in. There is a total number of chromosomes, which is just that. You know, every distinct chromosome, whether it's an unreplicated chromosome or a replicated chromosome, each chromosome counts as one. So there is a total number of chromosomes. But there is also N and ploidy that we need to define. I'm going to start with ploidy, which confuses the hell out of a lot of people at first. Ploidy is not how many kinds of chromosomes there are in a species. Instead, ploidy is how many of each kind of chromosome there are in a cell. N, on the other hand, is the symbol that we use to represent how many different kinds of chromosomes there are in that species. All right, now, did you get those definitions written down? Let's look at this example cell. And just look at the picture. Even though you can cheat and look at the numbers, I just want you to make sense of this with the picture. If you look at this one cell, how many different kinds of chromosomes are here? There are three. Why do you say three?
Because
right. Just like the different kinds of chromosomes in that human karyotype we just looked at were numbered 1, 2, and so on, each being a different type of chromosome based on size, based on number of genes it contains. There are three here. You see that there are three types. Big, medium, and small, we can just call them. All right, that's N. N, therefore, is three for this species. Because there are three types of chromosomes for the species. For humans, N would be 23. Now, ploidy is not that number. This is what students confuse all the time. N and ploidy are totally different things. The ploidy, as I said, is how many of each type of chromosome there are in the cell. So what would be the answer for this cell? Yes, there are two of each of the three types. There's two bigs, two mediums, two small. Well, we don't use numbers to designate ploidy. We use words. So ploidy is the general term that refers to how many of each type there are. If there are two, like there are in this case, then the cell is diploid. That's the adjective. We could call the condition diploidy. But this is a diploid cell because it has two of each of the however many kind, the two of each of the N kind of chromosomes. If, on the other hand, a cell has only one of each of the N types, then it is a haploid cell. And those aren't the only two possibilities, but those are the two main possibilities. You can actually be more than diploid. You could be triploid or tetraploid or whatever. But those are the two main categories, either haploid or diploid, two categories of ploidy. Okay, now, why do we have the colors here? The colors indicate the parental origin of each of the chromosomes. So these chromosomes are the property of this offspring, right? But they came originally from one parent or the other. Red represents the ones that came from the mother, the maternal origin. Blue from the paternal origin. Notice that all of these are also replicated chromosomes, right? All right, now, there's three homologous pairs here, right? But to be homologous, they have to be the same type. So only the two big ones are a pair, only the two middle ones, and only the two smalls. You can't take a big and a small. They're not homologous. You could call them a pair of chromosomes, but they don't correspond to each other. They control totally different sets of characteristics if they're different types of chromosomes, because they have totally different sets of genes. All right, now keep those definitions in mind because we're going to get back to it in a minute. Let's go to slide 4, though, and start talking about sexual life cycles. This is a sexual life cycle that you see, and we're using humans as an example here because those are the easiest to understand from our point of view since we are humans. But we'll look at other examples in a minute. Anyway, even though we're using humans here, the really important thing I want to talk about for this sexual life cycle is also true of any sexual life cycle. For any species that is sexual, features an alternation, a generation-to-generation alternation. I'm not talking about within the lifetime of an individual. So from one generation to the next, parents to offspring, to their offspring, to their offspring, and so on. There is an generation-to-generation alternation, or going back and forth, between two important processes that you see here listed in boxes. Fertilization and meiosis. So any sexual species will have fertilization and then meiosis and then fertilization and meiosis. That's what I mean by alternation. It goes back and forth throughout the generations. Well, we need to define both of these, starting with fertilization. Fertilization is the hallmark of sex. It really is what defines sexual reproduction. You don't have sexual reproduction unless you have fertilization. Meaning that a species is not a sexual species unless fertilization happens for that species. But what is fertilization? Anyone know? Often they're called egg and sperm, and they are in humans. Yes. Gametes is the more general term. Gametes is the unisex term for sex cells. Any sexual species features gametes, the sex cells. And there are two versions of gametes for any given sexual species. Male gametes and female gametes. But let me just give you a formal definition of fertilization. Fertilization is the fusion of two unicellular gametes to produce one unicellular zygote. The zygote is the direct product of fertilization. In other words, fertilization produces a zygote by fusing two gametes together, which is an exception to the normal case in cell theory, right? Usually a cell splits into two new cells. In fertilization, you have two cells fusing together into one cell. And since it's a fusion of two cells, that means fertilization produces a zygote that has DNA, that has genes, that has chromosomes from both of the parents involved, both of those gamete donors. which are the parents. And that's exactly why the offspring are genetically variable, right? Which is what is a crapshoot, but still overall for the species gives the advantage of sex, because it mixes things up from two parents. But think about the definition of fertilization. What happens to the ploidy during fertilization? It doubles. Fertilization doubles the ploidy, right? Because you're combining chromosomes from each of the two gametes into one cell. Right? Therefore, the ploidy doubles. Do you understand that? Well, that's really important, because if that were the only mechanism happening each generation, fertilization happens for each generation, but that's all, then it would quickly become impossible. You can't double the ploidy of a cell and then keep doubling that ploidy every generation, because you would simply run out of room very quickly. It's already astounding how much DNA, how many chromosomes are packed into a cell that's not only microscopic, but into an even smaller nucleus within that already invisible cell. But if you double the amount you have every generation, it's going to be impossible to contain that in a cell, because cells can't grow indefinitely. We talked about that, right? Cells are constrained by surface area to volume ratio. Well, you have to double the ploidy in fertilization in order for sex to work. In order for you to have DNA from each of the two parents, you have to double that ploidy. But since doubling it would quickly lead to extinction, because you can't contain that amount of DNA if you keep doubling it, because it would go from haploid to diploid, then to tetraploid, then to octuploid, and so on. Since you can't sustain that for many generations, you have to have another mechanism that will cut the ploidy in half. In other words, that will undo the doubling of the ploidy that occurs during fertilization. If you double the ploidy during fertilization, that's no problem as long as you cut it in half to get it back to haploid. Because then when you double it again in the next generation's fertilization, you're just back to where you started from. And it doesn't keep building each generation that way. Well, that mechanism is meiosis. That's exactly why we have to have meiosis. Meiosis is also a cell division event. Well, more specifically, it's a nuclear division event, just like mitosis is. And you notice the similarity in the spelling and the pronunciation of the words mitosis and meiosis. We've been through mitosis already. You should be familiar with that being a nuclear division event, right? It's part of cell division. Mitosis and cytokinesis together make up cell division in a eukaryotic cell. Well, mitosis does not change the ploidy. Mitosis simply makes two identical cells from one originally. It's a way to get more cells. It's how you grow into a bigger individual once you have your zygote that you started with. Whatever the ploidy is in mitosis originally for the cell that's entering it, you have the same ploidy in the two cells that are created, because it's genetically identical. Meiosis is similar in some respects. It is also division of the nucleus, but unlike mitosis, and that's not the only difference, we'll talk about the other differences, but unlike mitosis, meiosis reduces the ploidy in half. All right? This is why every sexual species undergoes a generation-to-generation alternation between fertilization and meiosis. Because fertilization will double the ploidy. Meiosis will cut it in half, bring it back to where it was, so that it can be doubled again in another round of fertilization. And then meiosis will bring it back over and over. And that way you don't build up an uncontainable amount of DNA in cells. Because of these two defining events, every sexual species, every sexual life cycle for any species that's sexual, like humans, will feature, therefore, two parts of the cell cycle that differ in ploidy. Not parts of the sexual life cycle, not the cell cycle, sorry. These differences in ploidy are represented in this figure by differences in color. So the seafoam green color represents the haploid stage of the life cycle. And that's why you see N here. N as a number, whatever N is for the species, N is called the haploid number. If a cell has N total chromosomes, that's because it has only one of each of those N types. In other words, it's haploid. So N is called the haploid number. But if a cell, like the one that we looked at in the previous slide, has two of each of those N types, then the total number of chromosomes would not be N, right? It would be 2N. Where N was 3 on that previous example, because there were big, medium, and small. But there were two bigs, two mediums, two small. So the total number of chromosomes in that case would be 2N, 2 times 3. And 2N, as a symbol, is called the diploid number. N is left as a variable simply because it varies between species. Okay, so here is N equals 23 simply because we're looking at humans as an example. But generally speaking, any sexual species life cycle will have a haploid part of the life cycle and a diploid part. The diploid part is the whatever color this is. Rose. I don't know what it is. Or salmon, maybe. Okay, notice that's listed as 2N. All right, so that's humans, which is just one type of animal. In slide 5, we see animals as an entire group on the left, and it's really the same as humans. All animals basically have the same kind of sexual life cycle. We have plants in the middle and fungi on the right. Before we talk about the differences, though, notice here that what I've said earlier is true. Every sexual life cycle features an alternation between fertilization and meiosis. And those events, which are required for it to be a sexual life cycle, define the two parts of the life cycle, a haploid stage and a diploid stage. So every sexual life cycle also features a haploid stage and a diploid stage. Now, the animal example, which of course includes us, happens in such a way that the majority of time spent in this cycle is in the diploid stage. And for us animals, the diploid stage is the only multicellular stage. We are a multicellular species, right? But we're only multicellular as diploid individuals. The haploid stage is only unicellular. We animals live our lives as multicellular diploid individuals. which means our multicellular bodies are made out of cells that are diploid. Each of those cells has two of each of the chromosome types. When it comes time for us to make our gametes, we use meiosis to produce those gametes. And meiosis, as I've already defined it, cuts the ploidy in half. So instead of being diploid, like our cells of our body, the gametes that we produce are haploid, which is appropriate for gametes, right? Because gametes are there to join with other gametes, and that's in fertilization, which is going to double the ploidy. So it makes sense to have haploid gametes so that when you do double the ploidy by bringing them together, you only double it. You don't keep doubling it. But the point here is that a human gamete, whether it's an egg or a sperm, is only ever unicellular. Now, we tend to think of humans as being only multicellular, which is actually not true. I mean, this is a huge political debate, for one thing, but scientifically, it's simply not true that humans are only multicellular. We're a sexual species, so we have a multicellular and a unicellular version. A sperm is a human. It's a single-celled human. An egg is a single-celled human. Either one of those will not get past one cell and still be haploid. So each gamete, each unicellular animal gamete, is going to either die, in which case it no longer exists, or it's going to join with another gamete in fertilization. But that ends its life as a haploid cell as well, right? Because if it joins with the other gamete in fertilization, it produces a diploid zygote, which is also a unicellular human, but it's the diploid version of humanity. That's how you started. Each of us starts as a unicellular zygote that's diploid. But in animals, that unicellular zygote then undergoes mitosis to become multicellular and still diploid, because mitosis doesn't change the ploidy, right? It just makes more cells of the same type. And so we grow up, we get bigger and grow up as diploid individuals, but our gametes really are other human individuals. They're just unicellular versions. All right, before we go to the middle, let's go to the other extreme, which is fungi. Animals are on one extreme, fungi are on the other, and they're more or less opposites of each other in terms of which phase dominates over which in the life cycle. So just like for us animals, there's a haploid stage and a diploid stage. But for most species of fungi, they spend their life as multicellular haploid individuals. Their multicellular body is made out of haploid cells, each of which contains just one of each kind of chromosome for the species. All right, now think about this. If a fungus is already made out of haploid cells, then it wouldn't make sense to use meiosis to produce its gametes. Doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to undergo meiosis, because you already have just one of each chromosome of your haploid cell. You can't split it in half again. You have to be diploid or more to undergo meiosis. And also, the goal is to produce gametes that are haploid. So if you're already made out of haploid cells, you wouldn't use meiosis to do that. Instead, fungi use mitosis to produce their gametes, which are more cells that are also haploid from the body of that haploid individual. Is this all making sense? I didn't see anyone indicate one way or the other. It actually does? Don't say it is if it doesn't, though. Okay. The two gametes from male and female fungi will get together under the right circumstances for fertilization, just like they do in us, to produce a zygote, which just like in us is diploid. Because of that fertilization, that's what makes it diploid, right? It combines the two cells. But unlike us animals, the diploid phase of the life cycle is only unicellular for fungi. So it doesn't grow up. That diploid zygote immediately undergoes meiosis to produce haploid cells by reducing that ploidy from 2N to N, from diploid to haploid. And each of those haploid cells then is the beginning of a new fungus, and each one will undergo mitosis to become multicellular haploid fungi. That make sense? Okay, so that's the opposite of us because we spend our adulthood as diploid, we animals. Fungi spent their adulthood as haploid individuals, multicellularly. In the middle is plants. And they're a special case. Their life cycle is described as an alternation of generations. That's the phrase that's usually used for plants. But don't be confused by the fact that that phrase also has alternation in it, which I've already used. Every sexual life cycle has an alternation between fertilization and meiosis. That's not what I'm talking about when I say alternation of generations. We have that, fungi have that, any sexual species has that. What alternation of generations has, which is what plant means, which is what plants have, is that both the haploid stage and the diploid stage in the life cycle features multicellularity. So that means for plants, there are two different multicellular versions for each species. There's a multicellular haploid stage, a multicellular diploid stage. Well, the haploid version of the species is called the gametophyte. Phyte means plant, and so gametophyte means gamete-producing plant. That's the version that actually produces the gametes, which from two different parents can get together through fertilization, just like in any sexual species. That produces a zygote, which will become multicellular by mitosis, just like in us. And so this is a totally different version that's multicellular of the same species. Right? Our different version is unicellular only. Plants have a different multicellular version. And that different version, since it's diploid, is called... I mean, since that diploid version produces spores, is called the sporophyte generation. Now, for plants that have been around for a long time, primitive plants, in other words, you can see both versions, and they look like different species because they have different appearance, but they're different versions of the same species. The vast majority of plants nowadays, because of their success evolutionarily, are angiosperms, though, and they still do have an alternation of generations. It's just that we don't really see two different versions of an oak tree, for instance, because one of those two versions, the gametophyte, actually only ever lives inside the sporophyte generation. Kind of like when a fetus is inside a mother, but for a different reason. We don't see it. We do for some species, though, like these ones pictured here. So that's alternation of generations. Both parts of the life cycle feature a multicellular stage. Multicellular organisms. All right, let's go to six. And talk about meiosis more specifically. To really understand meiosis, which confuses people at first, you have to already have a handle on mitosis. So hopefully you haven't forgotten that stuff. And you need to think back to it. I'm going to tell you to think back as I go through this meiosis part. This is not the best slide that could be used for this, probably, because I've realized recently, last couple times I've taught this, that this actually is too simple a case. This is the simplest possible case in terms of ploidy. What is the ploidy here? This is a diploid cell. What is the N?
One.
An N of one is the simplest possibility, right? If you have an N of zero, there's no chromosomes and no cell that's alive. But N of one is the simplest possible case, which is why this book thought it was a good idea to use it. But it's actually so simple that it becomes more confusing. I wish they had used an N of two instead. And I'll draw it when I need to. But anyway, does everyone recognize that this top cell has an N of one? There's only one type of chromosome, one size, and there are two of them, so it's a diploid cell. This top cell, or this top cartoon, by the way, is a lie, actually. You would not see a cell like this. Why is that? And I'm not talking about the number. It's possible for a species to have an N of one. But why is it a lie the way they have it pictured? That's close, but not exactly right. The reason that it's a lie, you're right that it doesn't. There aren't sister chromatids, meaning that these chromosomes are unreplicated chromosomes, right? A sister chromatid hasn't yet been produced. Well, when does that happen? During replication, but when in the cell cycle? The S phase of interphase, which is way before chromatin condenses to the point where you see chromosomes. That's why it's a lie. You would just see chromatin here, not chromosomes. Well, drawing it correctly, though, would be confusing with respect to the point they're trying to make. So even though you don't see unreplicated chromosomes, it's just showing you the amount of DNA that's present during that part of the life cycle before it gets to meiosis. All right?
So both meiosis and mitosis,
before you see them as chromosomes, yes, because they're already through S by the time they get to the M phase. They go through S and G2 before they get to M. That's when the chromatin finally starts condensing and you see individual chromosomes. The stuff is there, it's just not tightly compacted yet. That's why it's a lie. Okay, but anyway, this is a cell before it gets to S. Then it goes through S and G2 and it finally gets to the M phase, which is going to be for meiosis this time in this cell. And this brings up one of the major differences between mitosis and meiosis. You already know or remember, hopefully, that mitosis involves one division event. There's one splitting, which is why one cell that enters mitosis eventually produces two cells. One splitting event produces two cells. Meiosis, on the other hand, involves two division events. And that's why the overall process called meiosis is split into what is called meiosis I and meiosis II using Roman numerals. Meiosis I is the first splitting event, so the 1 and 2 are in numerical order, or in temporal order. So, along with cytokinesis, don't forget that you have to have cytokinesis as well. Meiosis is, strictly speaking, only division of the nucleus, just like mitosis is. But if you have it accompanying cytokinesis, then you split the entire cell. All right, so meiosis one results in two cells already, but then each of those enters meiosis two for another round of splitting. And therefore, one cell that enters meiosis eventually leads to four cells that are produced by meiosis. Okay, now, what did I say is the whole reason meiosis exists, or has to exist? Be more specific. To split what? To cut the ploidy in half, exactly. You have to undo the doubling of the ploidy that fertilization results in so that you don't build up DNA over time. That involves cutting it in half. So double, cut in half, double, cut in half, over and over. All right, now the reason I ask you that is because even though there are two division events in meiosis, it's meiosis one only and not meiosis two that causes that reduction in ploidy, that cuts the ploidy in half. Meiosis one does that. And here's where the picture kind of would be better to have an N of two. To understand this, and to really get a good grasp of the difference between meiosis and mitosis in general, you have to compare the two with respect to what lines up during metaphase. So remember, there are five phases of mitosis. Well, we use the same names for subphases of meiosis, but there are subphases in meiosis 1 and subphases in meiosis 2. So there's prophase of meiosis 1 through telophase, and then there's prophase of meiosis 2 through telophase of meiosis 2. And therefore, each of these has a metaphase. Meiosis 1 has a metaphase, meiosis 2 has a metaphase, and of course, mitosis has a metaphase, which you're already familiar with. They're not only the same words, though. Metaphase, whether it's mitosis or meiosis, involves a lining up of things halfway between poles, right? Okay, here's where you really have to get a good grasp of what's different about what's lining up halfway between poles. So, even though we're looking at meiosis here, think about mitosis first. Metaphase of mitosis. What is it that lines up during metaphase in mitosis? Not chromatids. What did you say? What kind of chromosomes? Replicated chromosomes, and even more specifically and importantly, individual replicated chromosomes. All right, so let's just say it's a diploid cell that is entering mitosis. How many individual replicated chromosomes line up during metaphase of mitosis? Well, you don't know the species. In general, what would the answer be? 2N. Yes, 2N different individual chromosomes line up. Okay, let me draw these. An N of two to make sure you understand this.
Do I have two colors?
Hopefully the green one will work. Oh, there's green. Okay, so first of all, this is mitosis, not meiosis I'm drawing first. Let's use an N of two, but a diploid cell. So in a diploid cell, you'd have a big and a small, right? And you'd have another version of big and small. You recognize this as a 2N diploid cell? I mean, as a N of 2 diploid cell? And it's in metaphase, they're lining up. Now, it doesn't have to be the two bigs are next to each other and the two smalls. It could be any combination. But the point here is that individual replicated chromosomes are lining up. In other words, we don't give we don't care at all about homologous chromosomes. We don't use that word in mitosis. The two number ones here, the big ones, don't care what each other are doing. That's why it could be, the other one could be down here. It just doesn't matter. Each individual replicated chromosome is lining up on its own at the metaphase plate, which would be right here. Okay, now let's compare that to meiosis. Metaphase of meiosis for also N of 2 has something totally different lining up. It's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up, but homologous pairs of chromosomes. So, it's like that. You see the difference there? The two number ones do care where the other ones are. They come together and form a pair before they line up. And the pairs line up, not the individual chromosomes. What were you saying?
So for meiosis one, they're splitting the homologous pairs. Does that mean that they're connected at a central mirror also? Because they take a split?
Or? Well, we haven't gotten to the splitting yet, but I'm about to. But first, let's make sure everyone understands that what lines up is different in meiosis 1 compared to mitosis, metaphase. Right? So how many things are lining up in general in metaphase of meiosis 1? How many? In general, not necessarily for this species. How many in general? No, that's mitosis. Mitosis has two N things lining up individually. Meiosis has N things lining up. Right? There's a homologous pair for each kind of chromosome. N is 2 here. In humans, there will be 23 pairs lined up in meiosis. But in humans, in metaphase, there would be 46 things, 2N, lining up. Because each of the two number ones doesn't care what the other is doing. Each of the number twos doesn't care what the other is doing. But in meiosis, they do. The two number ones come together, the two number twos come together, all the way through N. And it's each pair that lines up, not each individual chromosome. You sure you understand that? Because that is key to everything, really. Yeah. Well, we haven't cut it in half, but that's exactly where I'm going next. Because to understand what happens with the ploidy, you really have to understand this difference in what is lining up.
So for mitosis, it's 46 because they can be wherever.
For humans, it would be 46, yes.
Oh, yes, for humans.
2N in general.
Yeah. And then for meiosis in humans, it would be 23 because...
Yes, or N in general.
N, yeah, because they're getting paired together.
Right, there are N pairs because the reason they're pairing is because they're the same type. And that happens N times, yeah.
So for like humans, is it every cell that will have like 46?
Well, I'm going to get into that too, but... Maybe not even today because I'm running out of time, but I'm definitely going to mention that because there's two categories of cells in our bodies. And let's take care of this first, though. The reason it's so important to understand the difference with respect to what is lining up in meiosis 1 versus mitosis is that since different things line up in those two processes, that means what comes next, which is anaphase, the splitting part, is different. In other words, what splits apart in mitosis is different from what splits apart in meiosis 1. Anaphase of meiosis 1. So first, let's think back to mitosis. What is it that splits apart in anaphase of mitosis? Sister chromatids separate from each other. How many? 2N, right? You have 2N chromosomes, if it's a diploid cell, which we're assuming it is. And for each of those replicated chromosomes, the two sister chromatids separate from each other. And they're immediately renamed, right? It's the same thing, but we no longer call it a chromatid when it's no longer connected to the other one. Now they are chromosomes, daughter chromosomes. All right? Well, each of those is going to go to its own cell. And that's why mitosis doesn't mess with diploidy. You start out with a replicated chromosome in one cell, and you end up with two unreplicated chromosomes, but in two cells. So each cell still has the same number of chromosomes. It's just that the two that are produced by mitosis has unreplicated chromosomes, and the one before the split, it's a replicated chromosome for each type. Now, compare that to meiosis. It's not individual chromosomes that line up. It's pairs of homologous chromosomes that line up, and therefore what splits in anaphase of meiosis one is not sister chromatids, but the homologs of the pair. The two homologs split apart. They found each other, paired up, came to the middle, and now each homolog is going to go its own way. Okay? Well, now, think about the two cells that are produced, which I'll just quickly draw. Each of those two cells is going to have just one of each type now, because you split up the pair. Does that make sense? And therefore, this first division is the one that accomplishes the cutting of the ploidy in half. You started with a diploid cell, you end up with two cells that are each haploid. But in mitosis, you end up with two cells that are still diploid. It's just that each chromosome is now unreplicated. Versus replicated. Oh, I'm sorry. You have one. You have two of each, but they're both unreplicated. All right? Does that make sense? Now look at this picture, which is why I was saying this is confusing before, because with an N of one, it's so simple that you don't really see this as lining up, which they are. This is one pair lining up at the metaphase plate. It's better to look at it as two, though, to see that it's pairs that are lining up. If this were mitosis, though, you would have these things individually lining up, not as a pair. All right, so these two that are drawn under the meiosis one header, do you recognize that these are already both haploid cells? Each of them already has just one of each of the N types of cells. There's only one type. N is one. All right? But even though that's the goal is to reduce the ploidy in half, which is accomplished in meiosis one, even though we've reached that goal, we're not done. Why can we not be done yet? Because they're still replicated. Since we didn't split chromatids apart, we split homologs apart. And that's why you need a second round, which is pretty much just like mitosis. Meiosis 2 operates just like mitosis, so that these now unreplicated chromosomes, I mean, these now haploid cells will have their replicated chromosomes line up. And then in meiosis 2, those two sister chromatids will split apart. And the same thing's happening in the other cell that's produced by meiosis one. So overall, you have four cells that are produced. Just like mitosis itself does not change the ploidy, meiosis two does not change the ploidy. The ploidy changes in meiosis one. It goes from diploid to haploid, and then those already haploid cells split their chromatids to produce two haploid cells with unreplicated chromosomes, for a total of four overall haploid cells with unreplicated chromosomes. And another big difference is that since these cells are haploid, they are not genetically identical to the original cell that entered meiosis, whereas in mitosis, the daughter cells that are produced are genetically identical to the original one. They're also, though, genetically distinct from each other. The four haploid cells are not the same as each other. All right, so we'll see other differences next time. But we're pretty much done with that slide.